I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Enrique Peña Nieto wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in early July outlining what he planned to do as the president-elect of Mexico. He's a member of the PRI party, which ran the country through most of the 20th century. Peña Nieto said he wanted to fix the slow-growing economy, which has made life tough for millions of Mexicans. He called for political, education, energy, and labor reform, and he promised to address the problem of organized crime and drug trafficking, quote, head on. Well, today we want to talk about America's neighbor to the south and what this election may mean for U.S.-Mexico relations. And we asked George Grayson to join us. He's the class of 1938 professor of government emeritus at the College of William and Mary. He's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia, spoke there last night. And he's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And he's co-author of a new book with Samuel Logan. It's called The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. And George Grayson, it's been a couple of years, but nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
The pleasure's mine.
Nice to have you here. Help us understand who this new president is. Enrique Peña Nieto, he's been described as being very telegenic. He was a governor for some time. How do you see him?
He is all those things. He's been preparing for the presidency for 5 years. And his campaign, which culminated in the July 1 election, was driven by the media. He spent hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars, with Televisa, which is the major media group in Mexico, a little bit less with TV Azteca. And so we know that he's handsome. We know that he's spoken in generalities. He has a wife almost as beautiful as you. She's a former TV personality, and he is an indefatigable campaigner. He also has the benefit of the PRI, the long-ruling party, which has the best structure in the country. Now, getting him to move from generalities to specifics is the next goal.
Now, he says he represents a new generation of the PRI. Do you think he's correct, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's too soon to tell. What we're probably going to see is a mixed cabinet. That is, in the economic areas, finance, the central bank, the economy ministry, Mexico is on automatic pilot. It has pursued sound macroeconomic policies. It's going to grow by about 3 to 3.9% this year. Investment is cascading in, especially in the auto industry. Their foreign reserves have never been higher. There is A1 economic management. So that will continue. The question is, are there going to be political reforms? And this is where I guess I'm a bit skeptical.
Well, and the PRI has been out of office, so to speak, for about the last, 12 years or so. But it ran Mexico through most of the 20th century. Questions about allegations or facts about corruption and nepotism, human rights abuses. It has a pretty egregious track record.
The PRI does have an egregious track record, but so do all the other parties. The outgoing party, the National Action Party, the party of outgoing President Felipe Calderón, used to be a small, elite, middle-class party infused with democratic values. It won a number of seats in the Congress, a number of governorships, and although I think Felipe Calderón, whom I guess I've known for 25 years, as I was telling Queen Elizabeth yesterday, I hate name droppers, but I think he's honest as the day is long. But there are a lot of shadowy members in his entourage, especially at the gubernatorial level. And the left, which is the core of which is the PRD, is an offshoot of the PRI and follows many of the old and worst PRI habits.
Well, speaking of the Democratic Revolution Party, the PRD, its presidential candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is challenging the results of this election. He has done this before. Does he have any ground to stand on from your perspective?
Yes and no, to give you a forthright answer.
Yeah.
3 days before the election, he and the three other presidential candidates signed a pact in Mexico City at the Mexican Federal Electoral Institute. And there was a great deal of ballyhoo and press coverage. And in that pact, he said that he would accept the results of this electoral institute known as IFE, which does a count that is publicized 3 days after the election. They all sign their names. Now he's saying that there was so much hanky-panky going on, such Midas-like expenses on the part of Peña Nieto, that he no longer thinks that the election was fair. He has been in four elections, two in his native state of Tabasco, two now at the federal level. He has never accepted the results, and he's not going to accept the results of these elections.
But were they free and fair elections?
The actual voting is free and fair. It's more transparent, Marty, than elections in our country, because you have one voter registration roll, you have uncounterfeitable or difficult to counterfeit identification cards. When you get your ballot, your picture is there also next to your name. But the problem is, and we can empathize with this because of the U.S. situation, is that just over-the-top expenditures were made, especially by the PRI, on mass media, credit cards that you could use at a major grocery chain, other, shall we say, irregularities. But the thing is that López Obrador knew all that the Thursday before the election, and yet he signed a pact saying, I will abide by the preliminary results. And now he's contesting them.
So do you think Enrique Peña Nieto will become the president of Mexico on December 1st?
I think he will, but it's not going to be without a challenge. 6 years ago, when López Obrador lost not by 7 percentage points, as was the case this year, but by less than 1 percentage point, he sought to block the investiture of President Calderón. And so President Calderón was really sneaked in the back of the Congress. He all of a sudden showed up on the podium, put his right hand up, and then disappeared. But he was invested. But López Obrador has more shock troops now, because there's a major youth movement that's sprung up, and many of them are doing his bidding.
And this youth movement seems to be critical of Peña Nieto, the president-elect.
Yes, it's sometimes analogized to the Arab Spring. I think there are many more differences than similarities. The youth movement sprang from a confrontation that Peña Nieto had at the Ibero-American University. Your listeners may not be familiar with that, but it's one of the elite universities. The students who go there are known as fresas, or strawberries. That is, they're the best and the brightest and from the most affluent families. And so Peña Nieto was trying to make a speech there, and he was virtually hooted out of the hall. And then students from another elite university, the ETOM, joined forces. But since then, the movement has mushroomed, and you have groups from probably scores of universities. And they tend to be, first of all, critical of Televisa, the media conglomerate, which they say sold Peña Nieto to the people. And secondly, they're critical of Peña Nieto. These, though, are middle-class kids who are living or who are leading the movement. And they think that by doing something like surrounding Televisa's headquarters, that they can change the programming. Or going to the PRI headquarters and protesting, they can somehow change the PRI.
But isn't that what protesters do, whether they're successful or not?
It is, but there's no structural way which they can affect the system. It's a system that was built for a single party that ruled for 71 years. There's no re-election. The candidates are chosen by party leaders. You can't have independent candidacies. And this Federal Electoral Commission heaps hundreds of millions of dollars on political parties, including one small party, the Greens, which sounds bucolic and owl calls and so forth. And yet it's a family business run by the Gonzalez family. Everyone knows it. It was a coalition partner with the PRI. And yet they got $20 million of public funding. It took them 15 minutes to organize their board of directors.
So is Enrique Peña Nieto, the president-elect of Mexico, is he an empty suit? As you said, he ran on generalities.
He is often perceived as an empty suit. What his supporters say about him is that he knows what he doesn't know, and therefore he's not afraid to surround himself with people who can fill in his gaps, and therefore he needs a large entourage. And so he's got one of the brightest people in the country, Luis Videgaray Caso, who managed his campaign, is now managing his transition program, and is likely to be his chief of staff in the presidential palace. He has a first-rate economist who, as we mentioned earlier, are going to continue with the sound, responsible macroeconomic policies. But he's also, because the PRI's been out of power for 12 years, there are a lot of people who want jobs. Mm. And some of them you might not want to pass in a dark alley.
Because what? These are criminals? These are dangerous people?
No, no. They're lovely people, and I enjoy chatting with them and going to their
What do you
homes.
Mean? What do you mean?
Well, they have, shall we say, enriched themselves in ways that are greater than you would with a government salary, and most of them work for the government during their lives. And so they're known as dinosaurios, or dinosaurs. And there are a number of dinosaurs who help to deliver the vote, mm-hmm. and therefore they're going to get some patronage, as would occur with a Daily Machine in Chicago or the old Boss Tweed machine in New York.
Talking, though, about the economy, we're about a minute away from our first break here. How hard was Mexico hit by the global recession that has taken down so many economies around the world?
Mexico did much better than all the European countries put together, mm. except Germany, and certainly better than the United States, because they had sound fiscal management, and they didn't get into the derivatives business, at least not to the extent that New York financial institutions did. And so the economy is a bright spot in terms of growth. It's just the income distribution is terrible.
In fact, half of the country is poor, I guess, by Mexico standards.
Half might be an exaggeration, but certainly a third to 40% live as rag pickers in fetid slums mm-hmm. or on postage-sized farm plots.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about Mexico with our guest, George Grayson. He's a professor of government emeritus at the College of William and Mary, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is located here in Philadelphia. He's also a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written several books about Mexico, the newest one called The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. We do want to talk about this book after this very short break. And we do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions about Mexico, give us a call. We'll be right back.
St. Francis Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack happens, the faster the blockage can be opened, the less likely permanent heart damage will occur. St. Francis's cardiovascular team has worked to reduce the time it takes to get a patient from the ER to receiving life-saving catheterization procedures to 50 minutes or less, versus the 90-minute national average. More at stfrancishealthcare.org. At St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington, we specialize in you.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
Whether it's on small screens or large, Bill Bellamy has been making audiences laugh for years, and he doesn't have to look far to get his material.
My life is hilarious. I'm not even just saying it. Like, my life is bugged out.
We'll hear more about Bill Bellamy's hilarious life and work. It's part of our Make Me Laugh summer series. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about Mexico, its president-elect, and we will be talking about the drug war in Mexico and obviously the questions it raises for the U.S. And again, our guest is George Grayson. And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Another appointment that President-elect Peña Nieto made was to appoint a Colombian general to head up this organization, or I guess a group of a special police force to deal with the problem of I guess, what, organized crime, drug cartels in Mexico.
Yes, General Oscar Naranjo has been named the top policeman in the world two or three times. He spearheaded the move against the Cali cartel in Colombia and helped to fragment it. After that, even as he continued his anti-cartel activities, he became the chief of the Colombian National Police. He is tough. He is savvy. And while Colombia probably now exports more cocaine than ever, the cities are safe. And that's in part because of General Naranjo and the overwhelming support he got from the former president of Colombia, Alvaro Uribe.
But it's interesting that Peña Nieto went outside of the country to head up what seems like a very important part of his effort to deal with the problems of drug crimes and drug violence.
Yes, and between you and me and your listeners, the Mexican army is not pleased that the apparent president-elect brought a foreigner in. The only thing that would have been worse is if he had brought in a U.S. general because of the toxic nationalism that reigns in the barracks.
But at the same time, is he saying he doesn't trust the army, he doesn't trust the police, that he meaning the president-elect, wants his own person, his own man to head up this force?
Well, in all fairness, you need a sound police force to be able to pursue criminals. Mexico has never had an honest, effective, reliable police force in its history. And so you've got to start from scratch. Therefore, Felipe Calderon dispatched the army as really the spear point in his local war against drugs. The army is taught to pursue, to capture, to kill. And there's been a lot of collateral damage, I guess is the Pentagon euphemism, as well as human rights violations. And so he wants to bring in somebody who has a military background, but has also reorganized a police force. And so I think it's a logical move. But I can tell you, Peña Nieto's three priorities with regard to the drug war: reduce the violence, reduce the violence, reduce the violence.
But was Calderon in any way successful in his war against the drug cartels? I've read several numbers, everything from 47,000 people dying in the last 6 years. I've read as much as 60,000. In fact, that's what the president-elect wrote in the New York Times. Lots of collateral damage, civilians caught in the crossfire.
The problem is that without a honest, effective police force. In addition, the military has been corrupted because of its interaction with the cartels. Calderon, who leaves office on December 1, followed a kingpin strategy. And so he went after the barons of the cartels. And he was successful. He has a number of heads in his trophy case, so to speak. But the problem with the kingpin strategy is that once you arrest or kill a capo, the lieutenants then engage in a free-for-all fight to pursue him. Rival cartels see a vacuum. They move into the turf. And there are these insidious gangs of young people that are associated with the cartels now who act up. And so the kingpin strategy has, in fact, exacerbated the violence rather than cooled it. But Calderon, without a police force, really didn't have too many choices.
Well, speaking of heads, I mean, we read about decapitations, body parts, mass killings, bodies by the side of the road as a kind of, I don't know if it's a message to the civilian population or a message to rival gangs, but the sadism associated with some of this violence is really breathtaking.
It's unspeakable.
Torture.
And Los Zetas have really pioneered it. And what they want is what I call cartel credibility or cartel cred. That is, they're not a big trafficker in drugs. So they rely more on extortion, kidnapping. They harvest body parts, for example, for sale. They have lots of street vendors, prostitution, gambling venues. They're into probably 20 lines of crime. But they want to go into Marty's auto dealership and say, you need protection because you've got this showroom full of new Cadillacs. And for $50,000 a month, we'll protect you. And you know that if you don't buy that protection, they will have no hesitation whatsoever to pick up a child of yours, a parent of yours, and they will butcher him or her. And so this sadistic approach is designed to just infuse fear in the public, in the police, in the military, and it's in other cartels also.
What do they want? And your book is about Los Zetas.
They want money.
They want money.
Yeah.
It's a
business kind of operation. But the problem is there's been what I call a Zetanization of the country, because other cartels, such as the Sinaloa cartel, which is the largest and the best known, and the Gulf cartel that the Zetas used to work for, they're business people. They want to make as much money they can, but they want to avoid the gratuitous bloodshed. Mm. So the Zetas have come in, and now the other cartels, just to try to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, are engaging in decapitations, are engaging in torture. So it's a gruesome situation.
Did they start as a drug cartel and now have become a money cartel?
The Zetas started as the bodyguards for the leader of the Gulf cartel. We'll call him OCL, mainly because that was his name. Mm. And he was paranoid. He knew everybody was out to get him because he was killing friends right and left. He was known as the friend killer. And so he wanted a Praetorian Guard. And he managed to make contact with the Army and get about 30 members of the Special Forces. And they became the Zetas. And they eventually, after OCL was captured, he's since been extradited to the United States, they began to branch out on their own, and that's when they started these just incredible acts of savagery and brutalism.
Does it have a leader, or is it a consortium of leaders?
No, there are two leaders, one whom I call the Executioner, which is the title of the book. He's a nice-looking a young man who could be a choir boy or a member of a choir. He's in his early 40s. He's from Hidalgo State, and he was a member of the Special Forces. His partner in crime is called El 40, the 40, and he's the one who gets off most on savage activities. Mm-hmm. And he sort of worked his way up in the Gulf cartel. For a while was a local policeman, which is not unusual that police then move into organized crime. And so these two operate. They don't hang out together. They communicate by cell phone maybe once a month. And they have their own venues or plazas, which they control.
When you say gets off on, meaning enjoys the kind of gets brutality?
Gets a thrill from it. Not to have your listeners turn off their radios, but as I mentioned, one of their activities is that they sell contraband. And the street vendors are supposed to turn in all the profits except a small amount that they keep. Quarenta thought that street vendors were skimming profits. He went to their boarding house with his thugs. He lined them up against the wall. The first vendor, he used a 2x4 to beat into smithereens so you couldn't recognize that he had ever been a human being or was ever alive. The second one, he took a butcher knife, plunged it through his thorax, and pulled out his heart. Mm. The message was, you don't skim from Los Zetas.
I mean, it sounds like a reign of terror in parts of, I guess, parts of Mexico.
Well, if I were going to a beach, I wouldn't hesitate to go to Cancun or to Puerto Vallarta. These are long trafficking routes, and most of this concentrated violence is usually against either someone who's working for you and seems not to be cooperating fully, or it's against the police who may not still be working for you, or it's against opposing rival cartels.
That's George Grayson, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Mexico, its president-elect, and his new book that he's co-authored with Samuel Logan. It's called The Executioner's Men, and it's subtitled Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So going back to what you said, and actually what President-elect Enrique Peña Nieto said, how is he and is he capable of taking on Los Zetas, even with this new general from that he's bringing in from neighboring Colombia?
Well, everyone's against Los Zetas. The Mexican government, especially its army, its navy, which is a more efficient force than the army, the Gulf cartel, the Sinaloa cartel. It's everyone wants to beat up on the Zetas.
Right.
They want to extirpate the Zetas. And they may be successful. But the Zetas are a relatively small movement, probably fewer than 1,000 cadres. But they've got thousands upon thousands of what they call ninis. And these are young Mexicans who neither study nor work. And so for $10-$15 a day, they will serve as lookouts. They will serve as couriers. If they do a good job there, they may become gunmen. And there's a great deal of social mobility in the Zetas because it used to be it took years to move up to become a sicario or a gunman. Now you can move up in 13 months. And there's a certain panache that comes with being a member of the Zetas. Mm. You have more money. You have a fancy weapon. You have the best clothes. You have the prettiest girlfriend.
I'm wondering if there are any lessons that can be drawn from organized crime in this country, I guess, in its past heyday, where it did become more violent and where it did turn on itself and had rival gangs, and there were shootouts between organized crime in this country, where it really is, I think, a shadow of its former self today. Are there lessons about what happened in the U.S.? I'm not saying we don't have organized crime today, but the stuff from the 30s that can be applied to Mexico?
In the long run, I suspect that there's going to be legalization or decriminalization.
Of drugs.
Not because I favor that, and I certainly think that we should first move toward educational programs, that we should treat drug addiction as a medical problem. We should not be putting so many young people in jail who go in as amateurs and come out as professionals. But when you've got a substance that people will pay enormous amounts of money for, it's not going to be the little sisters of mercy who sell it. Mm. It's going to be criminals, and the criminals will become ever more violent as they compete for turf.
Well, interestingly, Peña Nieto in his New York Times piece said, in America, you have to deal with the demand side of the drug war, because I'm assuming that's where largely the customers are.
Largely, but one of the unfortunate byproducts is that probably about 20% of the drugs are now being consumed in Mexico.
Really?
That is, the drugs have been so ubiquitous that now you've got local folks that are smoking or injecting them.
But as you say, Los Zetas is really involved in a different kind of criminal enterprise then.
They do drugs, so to speak, but they are a multifaceted organization. Anything from kidnapping to extortion to the marketing of human body parts.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Adam from, looks like, Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Adam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was interested in listening to the program and hearing the talk about, you know, the pre and the pon and the elections. And I just wondered, I was living in northern Mexico during the summer of 2000 and studying the university there. And that was the summer when, you know, was the first election when the PAN had basically overtaken from the PRI for that 71 years of dominating. And there was such hope, I remember, and such an energy, especially in the youth around that election. And then, you know, the setup of the Mexican government system, I believe, is presidents get 1 6-year term.
Right.
So with that specifically, there was all of this hope and all of this, you know, energy. And then it seemed like it didn't have time to come to fruition before there was another election. And then there's another president. And it just seems like they've gone through so many presidents. I wondered if there's ever been, you know, research or what your guest has seen as far as why it's set up to be a 1 6-year term without any reelection possibility, and if there would be the possibility of reelection, say 2 6-year terms, 2 5-year terms, whatever it was, how that might affect the stability of the government and of the country.
Adam, thanks for
specifically,
the call. Now I hear you.
As you're talking about the drug cartels as well.
Indeed.
So that's my question.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that.
I'll take my response.
Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead, George Grayson.
It's one of the dogmas of Mexican politics. It goes back to the Mexican Revolution because there was a dictator in the 19th century who kept perpetuating himself in office. So effective suffrage, no reelection. And I personally think that reelection would be, it couldn't be any worse than what we have in Mexico now. But it reduces the accountability that incumbent politicians have. And the people don't want reelection because the people are probably more alienated by politicians in Mexico than they are in this country.
But looking at the political system, how much power does the president have and how much power does the party have? And now we're talking about the pre-party back in power.
The presidential powers have been reduced because now you do have transparent elections. And you have had the alternation in power of parties, with the PRI having held power for 71 mm-hmm. years, and then the National Action Party, the PAN, winning 2 6-year terms. The problem is that Vicente Fox, who was elected in 2000, was a superb campaigner. Turned out he couldn't organize a one-car funeral. Mm-hmm. And President Calderon, who's really a decent human being and has managed the economy splendidly, nonetheless, has just been overwhelmed by this drug war.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. Again, just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And if you're just joining us, George Grayson is our guest, co-author of a new book called The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created, talking about Mexico. Mexico also has a president-elect. The election was just a couple of weeks ago. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
The Man presents The Legend of Zelda, Symphony of the Goddesses, Wednesday, July 25th. Accompanied by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, The Legend of Zelda, Symphony of the Goddesses features original music spanning 25 years of adventure from the celebrated Zelda video game franchise, uniting music and visuals in a way never before realized. Tickets at mancenter.org or 215-893-1999. The Man supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Sigourney Weaver. She plays the Secretary of State in the new miniseries Political Animals. Another strong woman in a series of strong women she's portrayed. As a girl, she put herself in the shoes of any hero, like Davy Crockett.
I didn't ever think that being a girl meant that I couldn't wear buckskins and shoot bows and arrows and stuff like that.
Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Monica Brady Myrov. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Millions of kids who get free or reduced-priced lunch at school could be going hungry this summer. also reviled buildings, the ones everyone, except maybe the architects, think should be torn down. We'll look at some of the worst of the worst. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture Here and Now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about our neighbor to the south, Mexico, and our guest is George Grayson. He's written a new book, co-authored a new book about a powerful and violent Mexican drug cartel, Los Zetas, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Before we get to our callers, let me ask you, though, Enrique Peña Nieto, the president-elect, was a governor. Did he take on drug cartels in his state?
He certainly directed his ASE, state police force, to do so. Nonetheless, at least four cartels have been active and are still active in Mexico State, which is the country's most populous state, and it wraps around Mexico City. And the level of kidnappings was at a record high during his administration.
Really?
Of course, that's the case in other states also. But he did not have an unblemished record of fighting organized crime.
But if we're talking about police or even military's implication, are we talking about corruption or are we just talking about the level of fear that police are afraid of taking on these cartels for fear that they're going to die or be beaten to death?
Mostly the cartels will try to co-opt or corrupt you, except the Zetas, who really want to make a point that they're the meanest, most savage, most sadistic criminal organization in the world. But the police are not paid very well. Their training is modest. And international groups, including the United States, are trying to upgrade the quality of the police. Mm. And they made some success, especially among college graduates in technical areas, forensics, intelligence, technology. It's still hard to find a middle-class youngster who wants to become a police officer and work a beat.
Let me get, looks like Linda from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Linda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
Mr. Grayson. I'm very fascinated with this subject as I'm reading the book Savages.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought that this could come to California based on some of the marijuana growing operation there and some of the cartels infiltrating California.
Linda, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Well, Mexican cartels are in 48 states, somehow Maine and West Virginia have not been venues of their choice. But the cartels are pragmatic. And the last thing they want, even the Zetas, is to have U.S. boots on the ground in Mexico. And so while they are active with regard to selling drugs in the U.S., they in general have not tried to indulge in the kind of wild, wild west violence that you find in Mexico, not because they're altruistic. It's just that they don't want to be at the center of Washington's radar screen.
For business reasons, right?
For business reasons, but also for strategic reasons.
Let me get, looks like Jacques from Philly to join our conversation. Jacques, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I love your show. This is my first time calling in.
Well, thanks for calling,
Jacques. My question is, and just to give some context around my background, I happen to be a member of a prominent family in Monterey. Two of my uncles were involved in politics. One was the governor of the state of Nuevo León, which is where Monterey is located. My family also ran one of the largest conglomerates in Monterey.
Wow.
So just as that as context for my call, I was really curious to hear the speaker talk about the payoffs that are made from families like my own. And really in the context of, I've never spoken to my father or my uncles about these types of payoffs that have had to be made to some of these groups. It's an unspoken code really in our family about you know, the payments that are made. So I'd be curious to really hear about any research that he's done on these type of deal that are done for protection among prominent families throughout Mexico.
Well, Jacques, before you go, though, but you know that your family has engaged in these payoffs?
I do not know, and it's an unspoken code But I would imagine, given the name of my family and the wealth of my family in Mexico, that these groups, I'm sure, have targeted my family. And I'd be curious to, and also because of the involvement in politics in Monterey, I'd be curious to, yeah, to know of any research that he's done on how this all works.
And Chuck, just another question: is this, have you ever asked your family about this, or it just feels that you can't?
You know, it's almost an unspoken code, and we've never spoken about it. I've lived in the U.S. as many of my family members have because of all the violence. I'm educated in the U.S., and so we've never spoken of it. And I'd be curious to see if he's done research on other families and then how they've kind of handled that topic. And I guess my family's always kind of shielded me from the reality of that, I would say.
Well, I appreciate the call. And George, I'd be curious about your response.
Traditional families are less likely to incur the violence and the kidnapping because they're integrated into the social tapestry. Where you find more kidnapping occurring is with what you would call nouveau riche, or those who have earned wealth recently, especially those who are conspicuous consumers. So it's quite possible that a traditional family would have the contacts, the political, social contacts, that would be able to immunize them.
Jacques, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Morris from Princeton to join us. And Morris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm really enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
The information that we're getting is great. I just wanted to give perspective to the American public. I had a house in Mexico. First, I wanted to say that the murder rate in the United States is much higher than Mexico. Mexico City is 7.3 per 100,000. Detroit, Washington, D.C., Camden, Newark, they're all 12.3. 12-year-old kids in our ghettos have guns. In Mexico, it's very difficult to get a gun. You have to get it from the United States. We're selling them guns. We're buying their drugs. So I just wanted people to realize the news doesn't sell good news. So all of Mexico is indicted constantly because of this violence. But we have our problems here. And just wanted people to understand.
No, I appreciate the call. And Morris, we did a show about that yesterday, about the problems in Philadelphia of gun violence. But let me give our guests a chance to weigh in on your comment.
No, Morris is completely correct. And Mexico City does have a low crime rate. One of the factors is it's a sanctuary city. And the cartels have their families there. And so the gangs are active in the Tepito Market area or the Buenos Aires colonia. But no, I feel safe in Mexico City, although I don't go to shadowy parts of town. The difference is the grisly nature of the crime in Mexico, and that it's concerted violence. It's not just hoods on the street who decide to attack a senior citizen. It's a concerted effort. And regretfully, it seems to be surging.
Morris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We talked a bit about some of the television stations in Mexico, but I'm also looking at something from the New York Times about two newspapers in northern Mexico coming under attack by gunfire. This is a Monterrey-based newspaper called El Norte. And how much how much is the press targeted by some of these groups?
El Norte would be roughly equivalent to the New York Times in Mexico. There are three papers, El Norte in Monterrey, Reforma in Mexico City, and Mural in Guadalajara. These are first-rate papers. They have excellent reporters, and their reporters now don't use bylines in general, but they've got some criminal reporters who turn up incredible stories, even though there are threats and there have been probably 40 journalists killed in the last several years in Mexico.
Morris talked about American guns ending up in Mexico, and I've read numbers, all over the place from your reporting and from your research. How much are guns from the U.S. ending up in Mexico?
It's a serious problem, but we have lobbyists in this country who have a very expansive view of the Second Amendment. So the political reality is that you're not going to have state legislators, you're not going to have the U.S. Congress limiting guns. If the Virgin of Guadalupe were to reappear and there was not a single weapon crossing southbound. The cartels, it would be a thorn in the side, but not a bullet in their heart, because they can buy weapons on the international market. The Chinese make very good AK-47 knockoffs, and they've got the money to buy weapons anywhere.
But we do share a border with Mexico, and we certainly hear about border towns or even cities close to that border where the gun laws are pretty lax. There's a lot of buying and selling that goes on and guns that end across the border.
I don't dispute this at all. I was in the Virginia State Legislature for a number of years, and certainly the National Rifle Association always targeted me because I had a zero voting record for them. And they're a powerful, powerful group, and there are 20 allied groups. And these are people who will spend money, who will go door-to-door campaigning against you, and who will cite you in the media as being anti-American if you're not a Nazi.
Just to understand what you're saying there, though, but are American guns implicated in the drug war in Mexico?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Let me get, looks like Laz from Media to join us on Radio Times. And Laz, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Mori. This is Laz.
Hi, Laz.
I just wanted to briefly say that I am from the state of Veracruz in Mexico and that I travel there often. And most of the complaints of the people in the several municipalities in the whole state of Veracruz is that the municipal police is very corrupt, and they are serving the cartels. And this is something that has to end. And it looks like the federal government right now is substituting them with the army and with the navy, especially in the seaport of Veracruz. And I also like to tell you that I was stopped when I was there this past time, and I was really afraid because these people, instead of taking you anywhere else, they handed you to the cartels. And you end up dead, basically, while they're finding who you are and what you're doing. These people is afraid that everybody is behind their toes. And when they saw my American documents, they kind of backed off a little bit. But still, you know, they wanted to, you know, confiscate my camera and things like that. Just, you know, telling you that right now the situation is getting a lot better from the first time that I went there. But, you know, just telling people do not travel when they go over there, do not travel at night. During the day.
Well, Laz, first
that's
of all,
I have to say.
I'm glad you called in, and I'm glad you're okay. It sounds like a scary incident there. Let me give George Grayson a chance to respond.
No, I think the caller said it all.
Which is, I mean, what he said is that the police are implicated with the cartels.
That's right. If you have a youngster kidnapped, say in Veracruz or outside of Veracruz, you're not going to go to the police. You might go to the Navy, but the chances are a member of your family will serve as the interlocutor with the cartel, and there will be a minuet whereby you have a couple of conversations. But at the final analysis, you will pay the several hundred thousand dollars, depending upon your level of wealth, that's required to get your loved one back.
Wow. Laz, thanks for the call. Let's get Daniel from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Daniel, go ahead. You're on the air. Whoops, it looks like, no, we don't. Let's pull him. We're going to pull him. Let's pull him down. Let me ask you, George Grayson, because you actually, the last time you were on the show was another book that you had written about Mexico, and it was titled Mexico's Struggle with Drugs and Thugs, and also a book called Mexico, Narco Violence and a Failed State. I should say that Mexico, Narco Violence and a Failed State has a question mark at the end. So you were asking whether Mexico is a failed state. You wrote that book a couple of years ago. Do you have an answer to that question?
The country is not a failed country, but there are areas of the country that are failed. The state of Michoacán on the west coast is infested by a group called the Knights Templars, and they believe that they have a calling from God to execute members of other cartels and to safeguard women, children, senior citizens. They, in fact, were trained by the Zetas years ago when the two worked together. We're seeing that there are better conditions now in Ciudad Juarez, but parts of that city are certainly failed. When you go into Oaxaca, Guerrero, in the south, it's just a no man's land. Mm. And you have to be extremely careful, especially in rural areas. Veracruz, which used to be a paradise, has now been invaded by the Zetas, and they become the most deadly and most largest cartel in Veracruz. So they're areas, but that doesn't mean to say that Mexico is just infused with drug violence. And I go there regularly. The Mexican people are the most wonderful people in the world, and you just have to use common sense.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye here, what would you advise in the Obama administration in terms of this country's relationship with Mexico?
To recognize that we can help at the margins with intelligence, with equipment and with training, but ultimately it's got to be Mexico's establishment, Mexico's elite, that recognizes that they have to join forces and commit themselves to fighting organized crime. I would say we should not patronize Mexico. It's an incredibly rich country. It's got everything. And yet there is this big brother attitude that we're going to solve their problems. We have enough challenges at home without thinking that we can solve Mexico's problems. So assistance, equipment, training, but let's not be filled with hubris.
Well, on that note, George Grayson, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is co-authored with Samuel Logan, The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs, and the Shadow State They Created. George Grayson is a professor of government emeritus at the College of William & Mary, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. In fact, we posted a picture of our guest on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.